Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and Tim Rogers. I think you're on the line, aren't you, Tim?
I am here, Fred.
All right. Well, welcome back. I think we've had a hiatus for a little while there. We're trying to do a little catch-up here. One of the things I wanted to ask you before we get into the topic here is, have you seen much effect, I'm going to call it the Trump effect in the States? Has there been a big inrush of insourcing again, or bringing manufacturing back to the States, or are there other forces at play that's shaping where we go to work with our suppliers and contractors?
Yeah, it's really going to be interesting to see how this evolves. There are a lot of industries that have become extremely dependent on offshore or even, nearshore manufacturing. I think about the auto industry in the border area between the U.S. and Mexico. The consumer electronics industry, which is extremely reliant on the Guangdong province, just north of Hong Kong and mm-hmm. Shenzhen. Mm-hmm. So there's certain industries that have just become incredibly dependent on the global network of suppliers that exists out there. And this is not going to change overnight. I mean, you've heard stories about Apple and Foxconn who are talking about moving production of some Apple products to the U.S. And the problem, of course, is that most of the components still come from China. Right. They come from Southeast Asia. There's no supply base to support that production. So you're going to be shipping, you're paying to ship a lot of those components over from, where they're being supplied currently. It's unclear at this point what the long-term impacts are going to be. There are certainly a lot of companies who have already concluded that nearshoring is the right way to go. I mean, we see lots of examples in the auto industry, white goods manufacturing, like mm-hmm. Washers and dryers. These are big, heavy items where, transportation costs are high. We also see companies that are willing to pay more for nearshore production because it gives them more flexibility and responsiveness mm-hmm. as the market changes. I like to tell my students that your customers may want red ones today, but tomorrow they may want blue ones. And can your supply chain respond? And if your supply base is in China, it's going to take a while for them to respond. So you might be willing to pay more in order to get that kind of responsiveness. So I guess my point is, even before the results of the recent election, there were a lot of companies that were looking at this, particularly as labor rates have been rising in some of these places like China. Mm-hmm. We're reaching a point where labor rates in China are getting very, very, very close to labor rates in Mexico. And it's getting harder and harder to find the competition for experienced managers and supervisors and engineers in places like China. There's extreme competition and extreme wage inflation.
That's right.
So, for all these reasons, people have been taking a hard look at doing more production. But again, if you don't have that infrastructure, that supplier network to back it up, it may not be as simple as you think.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to be a wait and see how this all goes. But I think we've got such a global network now that one of the things that comes out of this, though, Tim, is as people – and we continue to move where manufacturing is done.
And
I think it will continue to evolve and change and move. But I'm just thinking is that we're getting good at doing this, is this supply yeah. chain network and so on is really, really good. And have you ever heard of the supply chain? It's a supply chain learning tool called the Beer Game.
Oh, yeah. Got it. I use it all the time.
Okay. Right. And one of the key features in that, right, is, and for this, for listeners that aren't familiar with it, this isn't a drinking game from our fraternity days.
I have to make sure people understand there's no actual beer involved, which is always a big disappointment.
Well, it would make for a much more interesting class. It'd be people would be engaged for the first part anyway. But the idea is that it's a very, very basic supply chain. If you have a manufacturer and they have a wholesaler that they ship products to, and the wholesaler sends it to a distribution center, and the distribution center goes to the store. And this is beer, cases of beer. And you set it up so that the truck drives and takes a look at the inventory, and or you give them the order, and then the next time the truck shows up, they deliver what you ordered. So there's this week of delay in between when the order is placed and when you receive it, and at each stage of the game. And as opposed to what we see today in our supply chains of, we have the capacity to get on the phone and talk to people across the whole supply chain. We don't often do that, unfortunately. Or we have networks of instant order. So when you scan a book or you make an order at Amazon, not only does the warehouse robot go pick your book and put it in a box, it sends an immediate note of demand note to the publisher to print another copy of it, or you know, aggregate that to trip a reorder sequence, and the book printer is looking at their demands and forecasting how much paper they need to buy, and that's all automated and going to the supplier. And so the beer game talks about, before we had this luxury of all of this data that's going all over the place nearly instantly, of how important that communication process is, of looking at forecasts, of looking at what's changing in the process, and just not reacting to the limited information that you may have in front of you.
It's really the importance of being transparent and providing all elements, providing the same information to all parts of your supply chain, making sure they all have the same information.
That's right. And it was the way the beer game set up is the store only talks to the truck driver who is from the distributor, and the distributor only talks to the wholesaler and so on. So it's a bit artificial, yet it really drives home the point of just a small change at the retailers, how it just whipsaws through the system.
Yeah.
And the students are always trying to, you know, I need to talk to that guy down there. No, it's the rules. Can't do that.
Inevitably they end up ordering way too much, or they have stockouts where they run out of inventory. And the problem gets worse the further upstream you get. It's a classic. I think it was developed at MIT in the 1950s, and pretty much every supply chain management class in the country, maybe worldwide, uses some element of the beer game. It's pretty low tech, and it works really well. But again, one of the interesting things about the beer game, Fred, I don't know if you've seen it played this way, but if you shorten the supply chain, if you take elements out of the supply chain, you know, by consolidation or vertical integration or whatever you want to call it, or if you shorten the lead time, all of a sudden, a lot of those effects go away. And again, this is one of the things that's motivating people to look at nearshoring or producing closer to home, because it does shorten the supply chain. It means you've got less inventory in the pipeline. You can be more responsive to your market. It may cost you more, but it may not cost you as much as you think it does. It really depends. You need to do a little bit of analysis to understand what the effect of labor cost is on your overall product cost. There are some products that have a very high labor content. You know, those inkjet printers that we're always talking about, Fred. Those, you know, the actual material cost for those printers was pretty low. You know, it's molded plastic and sheet metal and a couple of small printed circuit boards and some sensors and stuff like that. You know, it's pretty cheap. It was mostly labor. But there are other products that I've worked on, products you've worked on too, I'm sure, where the material cost is significantly higher as a percentage of the overall product cost.
Yeah, definitely.
In which case, going to a lower labor cost country, or conversely, coming to a more expensive labor cost country, is not going to have the kind of effect that you think it's going to have on overall product cost.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back to this information piece, though. So this, the beer game and a lot of the information you're talking about is making decisions after the fact, this responsiveness to changes in the market, right, and keeping track of that. And it's the essentially the customer placing demands on your on the whole supply chain, right, and then being able to respond to that. There's a flip side to that that I think is also interesting, and we're seeing more and more of it now, is that as you set up your system, is you're expecting information from your supplier. Now, there's two things that come to my mind in this. Is one is, we talked about it in our last episode, is all the testing that we're asking suppliers to do, or right, we're expecting them to do and report on. So there's all too often there's, you know, regular meetings of, well, what's on the issue list and what's on the corrective action reports, and the quality teams are tracking down one issue after another and just keeping right track of that. And then results of testing and yield and all these other things that come out of it. But I'm thinking of also we send products, or failed units that come from the field.
Right.
A natural piece of that is often of sending it back to the vendor. Now, right, I don't often advocate doing that. But if you do, it's got to go with the request, is what's going on here, and being very specific about that. So I'm all too often disappointed by what suppliers provide back. And it's not always their fault. In many, many cases, they don't answer the question you don't ask, I think is the problem. But in general, if we're setting up a supply chain and we're going to a vendor or a contract manufacturer, there's the usual suspects of, oh, I want to know yield, I want a new throughput, how many units did you ship, you know, so I can balance it off what check I send you each month, uh-huh, right? But beyond the financial part, from a reliability point of view, how do I get inserted in there the information I need to look at process capability, look at stability of the process control stuff, especially on the items that affect the performance of the reliability downstream? Right. Right. I mean, oftentimes I'm just a small voice in the overall financial needs and the status quo. Well, we just need to know yield. That's all we need.
Yeah. Let's unpack that a little bit. So again, we keep telling ourselves that you can't test in quality, and yet, you know, let's look at what typically happens. Mm-hmm. So you ask your supplier to pull some product off the end of the production line. You send it off for some accelerated testing, some reliability testing. They put those results in a file somewhere. The next time you have a quarterly review or a monthly review with your supplier, you pull out those results and look at them. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? That shipment of units, that lot is long gone. That lot is already out the door. It's maybe it's in your customer's hands already.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's way after the fact at that point. You know, you're actually just kind of hoping that the test results aren't horrific, you know, and that, you know, that is something that you can overlook. It's just way after the fact. You know, If you wait until a quarterly review or a monthly review with the supplier to look at that data and hope that there's nothing horrible in that data, then it's way too late to do anything about it. But we keep doing it, you know. And I like we talked about before, there needs to be some triggers, there need to be control limits, there need to be something for the supplier to take action on, so that if this test fails on X number of units out of this sample size. I mean, let's go back to AQL test limits here, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. If you get this many failures, shut down the production line. Call us at once. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, let's figure mm-hmm out what's going on here. Don't wait until the next quarterly review to report this data. But let me go even further and come back to what you were talking about, Fred. We got to look at process control, right? This is not just about what's happening with the product.
Right.
How many people are doing PFMEA? We know people are doing FMEA, but mm-hmm are they doing process failure? You know, are they doing analysis of processes as well?
Yeah.
Do they understand what elements of the process they need to be monitoring?
Now, that part gets disconnected so much, though, in the way we're set up is that here's the design, just build it. But if there's 15 things that are in the dimensions for this component, the manufacturer may or may not know which of those 15 is important.
That's right.
Yeah. And so it's part of that communication process, and it's setting up that enough information so they can know what's important, when to call. Yeah. Because I don't think suppliers are going to just call you and say, hey, we spotted an error. It's still in spec, but we're seeing a bad trend and you need to fix this.
Right.
Because they're loathed, and I would be too. I would hate to pick up the phone and say, hey, there's something not going right here. We don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It's much more comfortable saying, hey, we saw a problem, we fixed it, and we'll tell you about that at the end of the quarter.
Right.
You know, so there's way too much non-partner behaviors there, because it's all too often an adversarial dance because there's money involved, it seems like. And that's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate, but that's a more evolved relationship with your supplier, more highly evolved relationship. But again, we want to control the processes. We want process data, not product data. You know, we were talking earlier, Fred, offline about when I had a chance when I was working at Foxconn to observe a production line for a different product for a different customer. And this was a customer that was getting data directly from Foxconn. So the customer in the U.S. was able to look at data from the factory. But the data they were looking at was test results at the end of the production line. It's not like they were looking at the temperature of the wave solder machine.
Now, I heard that Cisco actually did that. When they were doing their outsourcing their manufacturing, this is years and years ago, I think it was into factories in Mexico, is that the engineers in San Jose had a dashboard that showed the status of the settings of the equipment.
Wow.
And what they learned was that the factory then left control to the guys in San Jose. You know, we'll just do what you tell us to do, rather than in being invested in actually running their process well and being on the spot. And because being next to the machine is different than seeing three measurements from the machine. And so there was a bunch of good intentions there to provide a lot of visibility and transparency of how the process was running. But it ended up disconnecting the people actually running the equipment from caring about it.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty evolved. Hearing that it's Cisco, it shouldn't be a surprise. Mm-hmm. That does sound like the kind of thing that they would do. But again, that does a couple of things. I mean, first of all, it really reinforces the point that we're interested in process control, not just what's happening at the end of the production line.
Right.
And it also helps the supplier understand that process control is what leads to better products. That's where you get quality. We keep talking about how you can't test in quality, but we don't always behave that way, do we?
No. I've lost track of how many factories I've walked into, and basically the manufacturer is saying, do you do process control? And they go, yes, we do. Here's our control charts. And they're on a slide from last month's production, you know, and that's the only place you see them in the entire plant is in the quality guy's slide deck.
If you can't show the data from today's production, then what good is it?
That's right. And it should be right on the line, right where it makes a difference, where the people can do something about it. Right. And there is one plant in Mexico that used to make telephones, the rotary dial telephones for Bell, the Bell telephone system.
Sure.
And they evolved and became a contract manufacturer for all kinds of stuff. They did manual control charts. And it was an amazing process.
That must have been something they learned from Western Electric.
It was just so ingrained in their system. That's just the way we do business. That's how we do it. And the only reason I was there is because their performance was so much better. Their products just were age. You know, the warranty rates for systems coming out of their plant was orders of magnitude better than anywhere else.
Right.
You know, and in spite of information like that, we still see people just implement, test it at the end, and ignore the process. And
you know, Fred, you're closer to reliability engineering than I am. Reliability engineers understand the failure modes of a product, but are we asking too much of reliability engineers to understand the production processes that go into making those products and what needs to be controlled in those? I mean, there's some key information that might be missing here. And I'm not blaming the reliability engineers. I'm just saying, if you don't know how things are made, if you don't know what the production processes are, if you don't understand injection molding, or how sheet metal is bent and formed, if you don't understand printed circuit assembly processes, then, do we even know what to ask for?
Well, Tim, that's why I darkened your door so often. It's like when we used to work together, you knew these processes for these components. You knew how these suppliers you were managing for our factory, how that stuff went together. And you could, you knew who to talk to, but you also knew their language and how their processes worked. Right. Where I was asking questions of the variability at this stage of creating a ceramic capacitor creates a latent defect that makes it more likely to crack. And how does that done? What do they use to control that? What's the right stuff that we need to monitor or evaluate? Or how do I tell if a supplier does it right or not? And I think the reliability guy needs to translate these risks of failures or these potential failure mechanisms that we're concerned about, and then find that at expertise, whether it's in-house supply chain engineering or supply engineering teams or the suppliers and their engineering teams or wherever it is. But that was one of the major concerns from one of the factory managers in Singapore, one of the last factories at HP that was still producing products for HP. Right. And he said, when I shut down the factory, I'm going to lose my talent that understands these processes.
That's right.
Right. And they're going to go work for Foxconn and, all these other companies that are actually making things because there's a career path there for them. And he says, if I have nothing but engineers that are overseeing the production of these other facilities without a prototype line here, without a way for them to stay current, they're not going to learn enough fast enough, and they won't be able to ask the right questions. Right. And his fear is that we're going to be at the mercy of our suppliers.
And I think this is why we see more product testing than process monitoring, because that's what people understand. They understand failure modes, right? Mm-hmm. They understand what is going on with the final product. They don't understand the manufacturing processes that are used to create those products. So I think that's part of the reason why we see the testing that we do. That's why we're asking our suppliers to report on product test results when we should be asking them to give us evidence of process control. Mm-hmm. But it's what we know. It's the people. Again, I'm speaking from the point of view of the customer. The customer has product designers. They probably have reliability engineers, but they don't have manufacturing engineers. Mm-hmm. So they're counting on the supplier to do that, to look out for that. But the supplier doesn't have the understanding of the product. They don't really understand. They may or may not understand failure modes of the product itself. So we're trying to bridge that gap between the two.
And it's usually not in the design specifications. It's not in the drawing. It's in the intimate knowledge you see in the drawing.
What you might see in the drawing is here's a critically functionally critical dimension, a critical to function, dimension of some kind. Mm-hmm. But we need to go further than that. We have to have a discussion about, okay, how do we create that part? What are the process parameters that need to be managed in order to ensure that critical dimension or that critical performance parameter? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's the next step in the conversation. We need to press our suppliers to provide that information. We need to make sure that we're turning that into a process control strategy, not just a product testing strategy.
Yeah. And, it, you know, it's a two-sentence question, right? And it starts a discussion that can make huge benefits to all involved.
And if the supplier can't stand, if they can't hold up their end of that conversation, we need to think hard about whether that's still the right supplier.
That's right. Yeah. I know we've talked about that before, is if, you know, if they're not interested in becoming a partner or growing their business and implementing this level of understanding of their own processes.
Right. Well, you get what you pay for. So at that point, you're taking some responsibility. You have to take some responsibility. Mm-hmm. If you decide to continue working with a supplier that doesn't understand their own production processes, doesn't understand process control, and you choose to work with them anyway, well, you get what you pay for. You're taking a big risk. And so that's something you need to go into with your eyes open. But I guess I would want to make that part of the supplier selection process. Before you choose to do business with a supplier, you need to evaluate them on that basis. Show me, you know, convince me that you know what you're doing with your processes, that you know how to manage your processes to make sure that you get consistent results, that you actually do control charts and you take action based on those control charts.
You know, I remember I used to teach a design for reliability course for managers, and it was, here's five simple questions you can ask to look like you know what you're talking about. You know, it was like, so what's the control limits on that? You know, what's the confidence interval of that number?
Good.
You know,
good.
And they love that part of this. We should probably do that for, if you're working with a supplier, here's the five questions you need to ask.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Probably that would be interesting. I can think of a few just off the top of my head. I don't know if we told that story before, but when I was working in China, somebody told me that they always wanted to look at the loading dock.
Mm-hmm.
They always wanted to look at the bathroom.
Yep.
And they always wanted to look at the bulletin board, because that's how you can really tell what's going on at a company, is how well they look after the loading dock. You know, do they segregate things, you know, correctly on the loading dock? How clean is the bathroom? Is it kept up? Mm-hmm. And what do people put on their, what's on the bulletin board? You may not be able to, you know, read it, but what is it? What are they putting in front of their employees on a daily basis? That tells you a lot about what they think is important.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. So I'm thinking that as we're talking, I'm thinking about four or five other topics that okay. go on for this thing. So we should probably wrap this one up. But if you're listening to this, I'm hoping for you also, it sparked a couple of things to think about. So what questions do you ask your suppliers? You know, how do you get the information you need in order to improve your product, to meet your customers' expectations, to do all of the things you need to do? It starts with asking for the information you need to reinforce that. And I think, Tim, you would agree, is it really starts in early in your supplier selection process and the design process. Well, what are those pieces of information that your supplier owns that you need to get access to? And a lot of that is process capabilities and process performance and how it affects your product. So as a listener to this, I'm glad Tim's back. I know you had a really busy last couple of months, so we haven't been able to record a bunch of them. I'm going to ask Tim to come back real soon and record some more. But in the meantime, let us know what you're interested in. What would you like to learn more about in the realm of working with your suppliers to get the reliability performance you're expecting, or even just working with suppliers in general, because it certainly is integral to creating a good product in one shape or another. So head over to reliability.fm. You can find Speaking of Reliability and the four other shows in the podcast network on various topics in reliability. And you can find plenty of ways to get in touch with us and leave us a comment or a suggestion, or how do you listen to the show even? I heard that a couple of times this week, and it's fascinating, all the different ways people are listening to it and what they're getting from the show. So we appreciate your feedback. So with that, Tim, any other thoughts as we wrap this one up?
Looking forward to hear more from our listeners. There's a lot of different directions we can go, and I always enjoy the feedback.
All right. Well said. All right. Thanks, Tim, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Very good, Fred. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.